Science is not about finding truth. It is about disproving truth, isn't it?
Truth is not a revelation that is handed down to us once and for all by higher authorities.
Gender, generally, is a social construct. This is a very scary idea for a lot of people.
Human beings are real things. They're not just social constructs.
Science, in the 19th century, gave us this thing called scientific racism.
The problem is not science. The problem is collectivism.
There is no correspondence between language and truth.
Language is just a game, and you manipulate logic, you manipulate evidence, you use any rhetorical trick in order to advance your group's value judgment.
And morality, to me, is a form of superstition.
Progress has been real. The status of women, the status of gays, the status of blacks, and all of the other races.
I never speak the truth. I'm telling stories, and you can like them or not. I don't think they're any more true than any other story about the Holocaust or about World War II.
Michel Foucault said, "I am simply a Nietzschean." And what we do know about Nietzsche is a ruthless power politics all the way down. You don't get individual liberty out of that.
Tonight's resolution reads, "Postmodernism is necessary for a politics of individual liberty." And again, I want to bring on arguing for the affirmative, Thaddeus Russell. Thaddeus, please take to the stage. And arguing the negative, Stephen Hicks. Stephen, please come to the stage. And since Thaddeus is arguing for the negative, he will lead off. You have 15 minutes to tell us why postmodernism is what you claim it to be. Take it away.
I'm actually arguing for the affirmative, so that's okay. I make mistakes too. And the good thing is, since I'm a postmodernist, that doesn't matter. It's just about being interesting, not being right. So let's start at a really important moment in history, 1961. I think it's a great moment for freedom, individual freedom. This was the year in which two books were published, one by this guy named Michel Foucault, this terrible French philosopher who everyone hates. He wrote a book called Madness and Civilization, which was simply a history of the asylum in Europe and North America, in which he talked about what I think might be the worst use of state power against human beings, or the worst abuse of state power of human beings in history, if you think about it. As you may know, after World War II, and even before then, but certainly after World War II, many, many people were locked up in these asylums, which were essentially prisons for the so-called mentally insane. Now, do we know who those people were? Were they just schizophrenics? No. It included women who were simply promiscuous or who sold sex, and it included people who were known as free thinkers, people who were simply dissidents, people who even believed in things like opposition to war, people who believed in free markets sometimes. Anyone who's thought outside of the dominant discourse of the time tended to be locked up in these kinds of places and reformed by being sedated, sometimes being sterilized, sometimes having electroshock given to them, or lobotomized, if none of that worked. This is pretty bad stuff. So what that was all based on, the justification for doing this to these people, was these claims made by medical scientists. Medical scientists at the Sorbonne, at Harvard, at Columbia, at UC Berkeley, and at Stanford, and at Oxford and Cambridge. Medical scientists using the scientific method studied a bunch of people and said, oh, well, if you have these ideas about politics, or if you're a woman and has these bad desires and sleeps around with women, or if you simply are something that we don't want in our society because you are weird or different, we're going to have to do something to you, put you away and reform you and assimilate you into the dominant norms of our society so that you can get along here. And many of those people never left those places, right? I actually used to live in Salem, Oregon, which is the home place of the mental hospital that is famous for being the site of the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest movie. That was fun. That was fun. They were doing lobotomies and electroshock into the 1980s there. Now, again, these were psychiatrists, medical professionals, scientists telling the courts, you need to go there. And many of these people, most of these people were not schizophrenics. They were actually people like me. They were like people like you, too. If you have divergent ideas or had divergent ideas from the dominant norms, you were very likely to be locked up in one of those places. Foucault then later wrote a history of the prison similarly, right? He said that it wasn't just people who were bad or criminals or were violent, it was people who were simply different, eccentric, crazy, in all sorts of ways. In that very same year, 1961, the year that Foucault's Madness and Civilization came out, another book was published by a man named Thomas Saz. We are familiar with this? Right. And that book was called The Myth of Mental Illness. Now, he didn't make exactly the same argument as Foucault, but it was a very similar argument. He said that these ideas about mental illness were really just myths. They were made up. They were made up by the state. They were made up by scientists. They were made up by medical professionals. And they were used to punish people who were simply aberrant, displayed aberrant behaviors in 1961. 1961, very important date. The next year, another really good year, was 1962. This was the year that Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions came out. Now, this argument was revolutionary, and this was really, in many ways, the beginning of postmodernism in some ways. It argued that science has changed. Scientific truth constantly changes. Science is not about finding truth. It is about disproving truth, isn't it? Any scientist you know should be a postmodernist. In fact, the real scientists, I think, are all postmodernists. They always say this. We're never finding truth. We're simply disproving claims about truth, right? So Thomas Kuhn said, well, look at the history of science. Again, just like Foucault. Look at the history of a truth claim. Anytime you hear a truth claim, just read the history of it. And Foucault and Kuhn said, in every case, here's the thing. There is a history. There is a history. These claims, these ideas about truth or truth itself, doesn't come out of nature. It doesn't come out of God. In every case, you simply look at the history and you can find that there was a point in time where women who were promiscuous were considered to be crazy and needed to be locked up. There was a time right then when people who were considered to be homosexual or were homosexuals were considered to be crazy and needed to be locked up. As you may know, homosexuality until 1973 was officially designated by the American Psychiatric Association as a pathology. And many homosexuals were locked up in those cages, in those mental asylums, and sterilized, lobotomized, and sedated. Thomas Kuhn said, science is always changing its mind, all the time. We are 1 minute completely convinced as a society that something is true, like the fact back in the day, that the sun revolved around the earth. Everyone just knew that was true. And if you disbelieved that, if you even were skeptical about that claim, what happened to you? What happened to you? Very bad things, because that was challenging truth that was supported by the church and the state. And it was universally agreed that the sun revolved around the earth. That was the Ptolemaic system, right? Then this guy named Copernicus came along and said, not so much. Maybe the earth revolves around the sun. Big trouble for him. Big trouble for anybody who believed this, right? And then Galileo got his problems too when he followed up on that idea. So again, it is this. There's an arrogance here. At every moment in history, we as a society are all, there's a consensus around what is true and what is not, right? And then a few years later, we change our minds entirely about it. So 1 minute, everyone's convinced that the sun revolves around the earth, and the next minute, everyone is convinced just the opposite. How do we know today that we are right, even about that, if we were so wrong about it before? Back in the day, not even that long ago, we considered this to be completely solid, right? Completely solid. No space in there. Well, what do we think now? There's atoms and there's spaces between them. This is as full of holes as it is of hard matter, solid matter, right? Completely radical idea that could have gotten you burned at the stake or thrown in a prison or an asylum. Are we convinced now that these scientific truths are true forever? When I say truth, that is a claim about something being universal everywhere, eternal, always, and applying to all people. That's a heavy claim to make in any case, right? So Kuhn really pulled the rug from that, and people started to follow that in postmodernist theory. Jacques Derrida, the most evil man on earth, according to Jordan Peterson, later in the 1960s began writing several books and articles in which he argued that there is no correspondence between language and truth. There was a common belief, it's still pretty common now, that we can ascertain, we can arrive at, we can find truth through language. Is that true? Is that true? He said, no, not so much, because language always changes, and all the words refer to everyone, every other word. When you look in a dictionary at synonyms of words, what do you find? You find just word after word after word describing the other words. There is no end to it. There is no word that is closer to the truth than any other in this case. Now, what was Derrida inspired by? He was inspired, like Foucault, by the abuses of government by the state in the 20th century. And in fact, he said his inspiration for inventing the idea of deconstruction, deconstructing language and texts and showing that there are internal contradictions and that there is no absolute correspondence between language or words and truth, it came from rejecting these claims made by governments that, with the use of scientists, that oh, things like, you know, Jews are vermin, right? Or women who are aberrant and don't behave properly need to be locked up, or that blacks are biologically inferior to whites. These are language claims about truth that needed to be deconstructed. That was his impetus, was actually an opposition to state abuses of power through language. You don't have a law without norms and language upholding them, which involve truth claims. So that is, to me, the origins of what should have been an alliance between lovers of personal liberty and these so-called postmodernists. But it didn't happen, unfortunately. Then, later in the 1970s, we had the advent of postmodernist feminism, which said that, again, women and, well, gender generally is a social construct. This is a very scary idea for a lot of people. But if you think about it, gender has changed. What it means to be a woman has changed over time. It changes constantly. What it means to be a man has changed constantly. The ideal feminine has changed constantly. The ideal masculine has changed constantly across time, across history, and across space. Different countries, different societies think of these things differently and always have. And even in this country, we have changed radically in our views of what is a good and proper and ideal man and a good and proper and ideal woman. They're contingent. They're contingent. They are not eternal. That means that they come from the minds of human beings, not from nature or God. In 1979, Jean-François Lyotard, another terrible French postmodernist, argued against these what he called meta-narratives. These claims that there are currents in history that just are ineluctable, that they happen regardless, that they are not contingent. That, in particular, progress is inevitable, right? This is sort of the Whiggish idea of history, that the further we go along, the better we get. Well, here's the thing. These guys, all of them, were born in the mid-20th century, right? And so they saw what happened. They saw what happened in the 20th century. What happened in the 20th century? This was the culmination of Enlightenment scientific thinking, wasn't it? World War II. This was the mobilization of scientists and engineers to build all those tanks and bombs and airplanes that killed 65 million people just in one war. Same thing in World War I. That was the use of scientific knowledge to wreak terrible havoc on massive populations. So we began to question science itself. It can be useful, it can build bridges, and it can build airplanes, but it can also build tanks that can drive across those bridges to lay waste to villages. It can also build atomic bombs that are dropped from those airplanes. Science and the Enlightenment can bring the best, and it can bring the worst. It is not just a forward progress. It is not just good, and it is not a religion. The idea that scientists and science should be respected and revered and believed on its face is possibly the most dangerous belief system ever, they said, and I agree. If we simply agree that scientists are always right, then they were right about eugenics. They were right about scientific racism. They were right about scientific sexism. They were right about some of the worst horrors that have ever been visited on human beings in history. These are all scientific projects. The idea of mental illness as a pathology, of aberrant behavior as a pathology, again, that was invented by medical professionals and scientists in the name of science. So we must always be skeptical of science. Don't reject it. This is another thing that's confused about postmodernism. No postmodernist just says, don't listen to science. Don't ever fly in an airplane. It's very useful within the sphere we live in the world we live in. But always be skeptical. And whenever anyone makes a claim about any truth claim, any truth that is rooted in nature or God, be careful and maybe reach for your gun. Then there was a confusion, and I have 2 minutes to try to do this quickly, that was really tragic for me and very frustrating. This is why I'm talking about these days. In 2016, sorry, I should say 2013, there was this new beast created, this thing called the social justice warrior on college campuses. These are the people running around saying, I was born with a penis, but I was also born a man. And that means X, Y, and Z about me. You, on the other hand, were born a cis, white, male, and that means X, Y, and Z about you. These were essentialist claims. This was a repudiation of postmodernism. This is the opposite of postmodernism. When you are told that you are such and such because of your body and how you were born, that is what the old conservatives used to do. So the SJWs were a repudiation of postmodernism, but a couple of Canadian professors, nonetheless, started talking about how what's going on in college campuses is the result of this thing called postmodernism. This guy named Jordan Peterson, whose mentor on this subject is this man right here, have argued that that is the root of these things, but actually it's just the opposite. It is conflict. Conflict between that politics and what I've been calling postmodernism. So I urge you to vote in favor of the proposition. Libertarianism and postmodernism are a marriage that could result in a brand new movement that could bring real freedom. Thanks.
Thank you, Thaddeus. Arguing for the negative, Stephen Hicks. Take it away, Stephen.
All right. So yes, politics of individual liberty is essentially an Enlightenment and a modernist project, what I'm going to be arguing. There are some elements of postmodernism as a comprehensive philosophical package. The politics is just a small part of it. What I am going to argue is that thinkers like Dr. Russell and some others who are attracted to postmodernism are doing is taking some of the elements of postmodernism, watering them down, and trying to then forge a compatibility with individual liberty. But this is a big project. So what is postmodernism is a huge thing itself. What do we mean by healthy politics, individualism, and liberty? I'm going to argue that those have to be at the other end of the spectrum. Now, I'm going to say, as a philosopher, some things about all of the major branches of philosophy. Postmodernism is a comprehensive assault on all of the elements of modernism, all of the major elements of the Enlightenment, of which the politics of individual liberty were one of the crowning achievements.
But excuse me, can everybody hear Stephen in the back? You okay? Okay.
Sorry. All right, good. So I should get a little closer here. But I do want to start with the politics, because while politics is important to us, the politics of individual liberty, politics is also important to the postmodernists. And there's a couple of ways of going at this. One is to look at the philosophical themes of postmodernism and their history. Dr. Russell does some of that. The other is, of course, is to sample what the leading postmodernists have said. And Dr. Russell did a very good job identifying who the important thinkers are here. Michel Foucault is certainly one. Jean-François Lyotard, another. Jacques Derrida, certainly another. I'm going to add to that mix Richard Rorty, the most important of the American postmodernists as well. So on the political starting points of the leading postmodernists, Michel Foucault, consider his philosophical political evolution, and these are combined for him. In the 1950s, he was a member of the French Communist Party, card-carrying, true believer in the entire package. He did break with the French Communist Party. By the 1960s, he was declaring himself a Maoist, that is to say, a follower of the program of the Chinese Communists at that point. He did eventually break with them. By the time we get to the late 1970s, he declares support and admiration of the Islamic theocratic revolution in Iran. So this is a man who does change his mind about political views over the course of the decades, but there is nothing fundamentally liberal in his evolution. Moving on to Richard Rorty, by our context, the American standards, he's about as far left as you can go. He considers himself a radical social democrat, and that is a position that he maintains. When, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, he is asked to reflect on the terrible, brutal, real, horrible, evil regimes that have come out of the far left, Rorty's response was this, quote, "I think a good left is a party that always thinks about the future and doesn't care much about our past sins." So an abdication of moral responsibility. We can tell a different story, put a different interpretation on it. We don't have to take the facts seriously. And that is, of course, part of the philosophical poison that we're dealing with. Jean-Francois Lyotard has long affiliated with a group called Socialism or Barbarism. In the early days, this was a movement that was straight up Bolshevik, but then as things got bad under Lenin and then under Stalin, they broke away and became Trotskyite. So again, there's an evolution, but not at all a liberal evolution. Finally, Jacques Derrida, most famous for his theory of deconstruction, which comes out of technical philosophy of language. But toward the end of his career, he made the following comment about deconstruction and his commitments to postmodernism. He says, and I will quote, "Deconstruction never had any meaning or interest to me, in my eyes, except as a radicalization, that is to say, also within the tradition of a certain Marxism, in a certain spirit of Marxism." Right. Now, what we do have then is a series of thinkers, and these are the big guns who are coming out of very far-left politics. But it's not just politics, and they do change, but they do not change at all in the direction toward liberalism. And the reason for that makes very good sense when you look at the underlying philosophical commitments. Of course, Marxism is a comprehensive philosophical package. It's not just in economics. It's not just in politics. It has a theory that's metaphysics. It has an epistemology. It has an understanding of human nature. It has an ethics. There's an entire package, and I suppose if you wanted to essentialize it, there are probably 16 important claims that Marxism makes. All of the leading postmodernists in the 50s and 1960s are breaking away from classical Marxism because they recognize the failures of it, and they are shifting in various directions. And in many cases, they are critical, as Dr. Russell points out, about some of the horrible top-down authoritarian abuses of power by far-left regimes. But being opposed to certain species of authoritarian impositions of power is not to be a liberal. There's lots of other places on the political spectrum one can move away from certain abuses of state power and still not at all be anything like a liberal or a libertarian. And that is what characterizes all of the postmoderns. And that makes sense when we start to look at their underlying metaphysical views, their skepticism in epistemology, their social construction, understanding of human nature rather than being individualistic, and then the corresponding very jaded views about the possibility for peace between human beings, the possibilities that we can work out win-win transactions. They do remain in the camp of believing that human beings are fundamentally in conflict, that it's always power domination, and somebody's going to win and someone is going to lose. So this has been an emphasis on the politics, and I've emphasized the Marxist roots, but I do not at all want to make the claim that postmodernism is Marxism. There is an evolution here through neo-Marxisms onto various forms of cultural Marxisms, and if you look at the history of the far left, the far left is a multifaceted, menti-splintered group, and postmoderns do not all occupy the same space. But what is true to say is that all of the major and the first two generation postmoderns are philosophically committed to anti-liberal politics all the way down. And it's important here then that the four postmodernists that we've mentioned so far, all of them are PhDs. They're very politically engaged, politically active individuals, but they are PhDs, and they're not PhDs in history or in economics. They're all PhDs in philosophy. And that's important because what they are doing is getting their PhDs in the 1950s at a moment when philosophy has reached a very skeptical phase. And it's going to be this skepticism and the consequent subjectivisms and relativism that leads to a hollowing out of all of the rest of philosophy from the postmodern perspective. And so there's a repackaging that has to go on here. But let's say a few things about the philosophical stance, that it's not just a political stance that's being taken here. Richard Rorty, for example, will say that the postmodern task is to figure out what to do now that both the age of faith, that is to say, the 1,000-year stretch from, say, the collapse of the Roman Empire on into the Renaissance and the Reformation, when essentially a religious philosophy dominated, that failed, that collapsed. The postmodernists say that entire supernaturalistic, faith-based tradition, top-down institution-based tradition as they understand it, that is a failure. But also, Rorty goes on to argue, the Enlightenment itself also seems to be, quote, beyond recovery. So that is to say, the entire modern project, that there is a natural world that we can understand through the application of our using our independent judgment, reason, and then in more complicated cases, sophisticated scientific method, and we need to continue to develop those methods of scientific method, an understanding that human beings are individuals with their own independent judgment. They're not born into caste memberships or racial memberships or anything. That we should treat people as individual with their own capacity to form their own judgments and govern their own lives, and then the consequent rest of the Enlightenment project. What the postmoderns are arguing is that entire package is wrong. Now, what that means metaphysically in terms of our understanding of reality is that the postmoderns are what we call anti-realists. So they will say, yes, for 2,500 years, the history of philosophy, we've been arguing about whether God exists or not. That is to say, we've been arguing, is the natural world, this cause and effect world, the self-contained world, is that it, or is there a supernatural world as well? So that debate, they want to say, well, we've been arguing about it for a long time. Nobody knows what the answer to that is, and that is to say we should stop asking that question. What is the nature of reality? Is it the natural world or is it the supernatural world is ultimately a meaningless question, right? We start to put reality in quotation marks. We start to put the word truth in quotation marks and distance ourselves right from that. But of course, if we're interested in a politics of liberty, one of the big arguments of the Enlightenment is we need, you know, we live in the real world, right? And the real world gives us feedback. It's important for every individual to have the confidence and the competence in his or her, increasingly her own judgment, so that they can understand the way the world actually is in order to live successfully in it. If you philosophically back away from that claim and start saying, well, there is no such thing as reality, there are only interpretations, there's yours, there's mine, reality starts to drop out of the picture. You're not going to support a politics of individual liberty. It's also important that the Enlightenment was, for the first time in history, a consistently individualistic philosophy, that individuals are the unit of reality. We're not fragments of a supernatural being. We're not born into a class. We're not preassigned to gender roles. Each individual has competence, has agency, has a basic respect. And that needs to be captured universally. So yes, absolutely, the modernists and the Enlightenment are gung-ho about the importance of a big meta-narrative. All women should have equal rights. Slavery is a moral abomination, and we need to get rid of it. That's a huge meta-narrative. Every human being has the birthright of liberty. Those are meta-narrative claims. And what justifies them is an epistemology that says we can figure out truth. Yes, truth is very complicated sometimes, and sometimes we only have probabilistic knowledge. Sometimes we're just speculating. Sometimes we make mistakes. But if we apply our independent judgment well, we can individually and socially self-correct and acquire better and better knowledge. So these concepts are ones that we need to maintain. It's important then to note that the leading postmodernists do not see people as individuals. They explicitly reject the individualism. Richard Rorty, the least radical of them, says somewhat apologetically, you know, this is a direct quote, "We are, in fact, stuck in our ethnocentric predicament." Right? So his position is, for individuals, their ethnicity is, in fact, the fundamental shaping part of their identity, that we all have to think of ourselves in ethnocentric ways. And since different ethnicities have different histories and different value frameworks, necessarily they're going to be in conflict with each other. So that then is to say we're anti-individualistic, and we are saying it's not possible to solve these historical problems and so forth. So it's a very pessimistic and cynical position. Some of the postmodernists, of course, come at it less from an ethnocentric perspective, but they do focus on linguistic issues. Dr. Russell mentions Derrida, and he is the most famous proponent of this view here. And there's actually several of them here, but the most important one here is the product or the view that language is a social product, and that human beings come into the world. They don't have individual agency. They don't have the ability to understand the world individually in terms of their own contact. Instead, the language that they are born into shapes fundamentally how they think and operate in the world and gives them their values. And so, therefore, we are all prisoners of our linguistic background. Now, of course, if you take that position, now I think that philosophy of language is entirely wrong, but it is exactly the one that the postmodernists buy into. And that is to say, it is anti-individualistic. Your very thinking and your values is a product of a group linguistic structure that pre-existed you. There's no way to get from that postmodern position to anything approaching a respect for individualism. And then finally, when we turn to the ethos, all of the postmoderns without exception, right? Richard Rorty again, to a lesser degree, retain not the classical Marxist exploitation theory, but, as Derrida says, in the spirit of Marxism, the view that human relations across multiple dimensions are deeply exploitative. It is this race against that race. It is these rich people against these poor people. It is the white people against those people. It's men versus women. And all of them are constructed by different groups, and so the conflict is necessarily going to be inescapable. It also means that since we are skeptical about reason, we're not going to be able to get past those differences. Think about our confidence in the free market or democratic republican politics. That's all about saying human beings can take agency, we can have our differences, but we can just talk about them, we can point to common facts and come to some sort of peaceful agreement and so forth. If you think that human beings are divided into different groups and they do not have that rational agency as a matter of principle, then you're going to say democratic politics doesn't make sense. The free market doesn't make sense. Instead, all you're left with is naked power struggles. Michel Foucault said, "I am simply a Nietzschean." And then what we do know about Nietzsche is a ruthless power politics all the way down. You don't get individual liberty out of that.
Five-minute rebuttal from Thaddeus.
So I and Jean and Foucault and Derrida all have something in common. We all began our political careers as Marxists. Now, if you were to look at my career as a whole, all my writing, all my speaking, and Jean's, I think you would not take away from that that we are Marxists at all. I think you would take away from that that we are very clearly anti-Marxist and anti-communist. That is also true for Foucault and Derrida. How do we know this? Because Noam Chomsky, Frederick Jameson, and every Marxist I've ever known, I mean serious Marxists, hate the guts of postmodernism. Why? Because Marxism is based on this idea of historical materialism, which is that materialism, the material matters in society, economics, institutions, the state, the material, the nature, that is what's real, and everything else is immaterial or less important. Things like ideas and culture, right? Now, that is exactly counter to what Marxists have said, right? That's exactly counter to what postmodernists have said. They have said that, no, there is no such thing as a natural truth, an eternal absolute truth outside of human consciousness. I had a friend who was a Marxist professor at Columbia who said to me once, "Are you reading all that French horseshit up there? We can't stand that shit because it distracts us from the real work, the true work of revolution. They also believe that capitalism inevitably results in socialist revolution, don't they? That's an essentialist, naturalist claim, right? That in capitalism is this intrinsic, self-destructive quality, right? And that the proletariat will inevitably, necessarily, naturally be the vanguards of that revolution. It's all superstitious nonsense, isn't it? Postmodernists called bullshit on that first and foremost, and that's why Marxists to this day hate them. Frederick Jameson, a very famous professor at Duke, devoted an entire book in the 1980s to saying that postmodernism has distracted us from the real work of social change and revolution. Noam Chomsky is still irritated by postmodernism and says the same thing. It distracts us from what is real and what is really necessary. If you are in the working class, you must, by your very nature, work for revolution. If you are a capitalist, that means something essentially bad about you. As for the Enlightenment and individualism, that one's hard to take because the Enlightenment gave us science, and science in the 19th century gave us this thing called scientific racism. Now, were these marginal scientists? Were these quack doctors and quack scientists? No, these were all the major scientists in all the major universities. They were the ones studying skulls, measuring noses, measuring craniums, and saying, oh, those are black people, and those are Irish people, and those are Caucasians, and they all have different characteristics based on their nature. That was a scientific product. That resulted in this thing called eugenics in the 1920s and 1930s. Which resulted, by the way, in the sterilization of 50,000 people involuntarily by court order, mostly women. Was that done by quack doctors and marginal figures? No. Pretty much every major, not just scientist, but intellectual in this country, operating in Harvard and Yale and Columbia and Berkeley and Stanford, were sympathetic or proponents of eugenics. These were scientists who believed this was true, that there were people who were genetically inferior and that needed to be bred out of the human race. That was the product of science. Do you know where Hitler and the Nazis got their ideas about Jews and about eugenics? From American scientists. There was a big interchange between American and German scientists in the 1930s. The Nazis got most of their ideas from scientists from this country. This was a consensus view among scientists, that there were certain races of people that were inferior to others. So one of the interesting things about postmodernism is that we, if I am one, don't believe that there's any true reading of a text. But all I can say is that my reading of the texts in question here, of Foucault, Derrida, Lyotard, and the rest, is radically different than Stevens. I can also say that my reading is much more common than his. Now, you can believe me or not, but what I ask you to do is do something that most of the critics other than Stephen of postmodernism have not done, is to read the texts. Read the texts. I don't think Jordan Peterson has read more than maybe half a book of it. I have never heard any citation, any quotes. I mean, Stephen actually offers quotes. He's actually read the text, so I respect him for that, and that's why I'm debating him. But Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, the rest of these people who go around yelling about postmodernism, they've never once quoted any of these people. Read the text. Foucault's not actually difficult. Derrida is, but that's what you have to do. You have to engage with this. And there's a lot of misreading that I think might be deliberate.
All right, I second Thaddeus's point about reading the postmodern thinkers. Absolutely. And this, of course, is part of a commitment to liberal education. And it is the modernists who give you liberal education. The reason why you read this side of the debate and that side of the debate is that it's essential for every individual to train his or her judgment. This is a John Stuart Mill point. It's a one that he was drawing on with John Locke, Michel de Montaigne, Galileo, and the others. All right, so absolutely, that is a modernist position. to be seconded. What we do find, though, is that the postmoderns do not offer that advice themselves. Instead, what you find explicitly in the postmodern educators when they take the high theory and apply it to educational practice is one-sided reading texts, explicitly so. So Stanley Fish, for example, one of the leading literary postmodern theorists, was engaged with this issue of John Stuart Mill's liberal education thesis, that if we're going to properly train young people to think for themselves as individuals, they need to hear arguments from both and all sides of the debate so they can make up their own individual minds. And Fish's response was to say, that is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. You do not want your students to read the other side. You want to squelch the other side's arguments. And that is part of the commitment of postmodernism, that you're not interested in training reason. You're not interested in training individual judgment. Instead, once truth is out, once individual judgment is out, what you have is the movement and your value agenda. Your value agenda is a subjective commitment that you have acquired, and the important thing is to, in a world that you see as a zero-sum power struggle, to use your power to advance your values. So if you are a professor and you have some power over your students, you don't want to take a chance that they will read the other side and come to the wrong conclusion right from your perspective. Fish's colleague at Duke, also a colleague of Jameson, took this one step forward, and I have the quotation. I'm happy to send it to anyone where he says explicitly, as a postmodernist, I am not interested in truth. I am not interested in knowledge. He puts those in quotation marks. He says, my job as a professor is to help students realize the horror of this evil capitalist world that we have arisen and all of the negative things that have come out of the modern world, and to train them to be activists to go out and fight the world. So I agree with Thaddeus Russell, but I think Thaddeus on this point is actually a modernist. He is not a postmodernist in urging people to read both sides of the arguments. The point about science changing is absolutely true, and that's a very important point, because part of the modernist project has been to say truth is not a revelation that is handed down to us once and for all by higher authorities. Rather, truth is something that we each have to work at very hard, and in the initial stages of any science, we're going to make a lot of mistakes, and we should be partially committed to our hypotheses and being open to alternative interpretations, and that science, if it's properly done, has to be a self-correcting process and open-ended. There are lots of things that we know, but there are lots of things that we don't yet know, and part of the modernist project is to be self-critical about exactly how much evidence one has for or against a given project. But if you're a postmodernist and you think evidence doesn't matter and it's all just subjective narratives, you are not going to train those skills. Part of the modern project is to say, oh, I believe this and maybe I overbelieved it, but here are some good logical arguments against my position, to be open-minded and to say, I have individual agency. I can change my mind and reject my own or my former beliefs and come to believe something else. If I see myself as an avatar of my group and I'm just part of a group advocacy, then I am not going to engage in that process. So what I would say in terms of all of the abuses of psychiatry, and I agree entirely that those are horrific, but think of it this way. The fact that some psychiatrists were willing to use state power and authoritarian methods in the name of their quasi-scientific theories. Consider an analogy to nutrition. Of course, there are lots of kooky nutritional theories, and what we should do on an ongoing basis is critique those and so forth. But the issue is, if I have a nutritional theory and I start forcing down your throat food that I think is good for you, right? I might have a bad nutritional theory, right? And that should be criticized. But the issue here is I'm forcing food down your throat, right? That's what we should be focused on. So the fact that bad scientists using authoritarian power were forcing their views on other people does not mean that there's no such thing, for example, as good nutrition, and that we shouldn't continue to do the science of nutrition to say, oh, it's all just theories and so forth, but rather we need better science.
Well, thanks to you both. And now we go to the Q&A portion of the evening. I want to exercise moderator's prerogative to throw a couple of questions at you each. Start with you, Stephen. Thaddeus mentioned two writers that you haven't addressed that was Thomas Sasse and Thomas Kuhn. Would you regard them as leftist, and would you regard them as postmodernists?
Thomas Kuhn.
All right, take the mic. Sorry, Mike. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Thanks for the reminder. Thomas Sasse politically is libertarian,
yeah.
And my understanding is that he is a moderate skeptic when it comes to epistemological and metaphysical views. He believes that human beings are real things. They're not just social constructs, that there is a difference between psychological health and psychological illness, even though he wants to, from my understanding, recognize that this is still something that we are in the infancy of. And on his politics, he is a he is broadly libertarian, right, of some sort.
You're good, yes.
Okay. On Thomas Kuhn and his important Structure of Scientific Revolutions book, I do see him as the most important philosopher of science in the 1960s, and he is definitely the one that all of the postmodernists, I think, correctly cite. So in chapters 10 and chapter 13 of that book, he says, yeah, I have this this analysis, scientists have changed their mind about stuff, so therefore the argument that Thaddeus gave us, that's exactly the right. But what he does is draw the conclusion is that therefore we have to start saying that science is really not about the truth, right? It's about something else. And then in chapter 13 he goes on to say that therefore means that we can't say that science has progressed. So there's no such thing as scientific progress. So we are not in any better off come to the 19th century, 20th century, 16th century, and so forth. And Kuhn is part of a coterie of deeply skeptical thinkers of that time. Willard Van Orman Quine, Harvard philosopher, for example, says, you know, I really want to believe that there are subatomic particles in the scientific project, but from my philosophical perspective, the Homeric gods and whatever the scientists are talking about right now, I can't say that one of them is any better than any other. Paul Feyerabend, also publishing at exactly the same time, and a student of Karl Popper's, we'll leave that one to the side, but Paul Feyerabend, at the same time drawing extraordinarily skeptical conclusions, saying the best of modern medicine as it has been achieved in the 1960s, and witchcraft. I don't see any epistemological superiority of one to the other. And that is exactly the postmodern epistemology, and Kuhn is part of that package.
Any comment from you, Thaddeus, on that?
Completely different than my reading of those works, and I don't think you'll find many people who have studied the works who would agree with Stephen's interpretation of this. You'd have to check this yourself. So it's very hard to respond to things that just don't comport at all with my readings. Do you want me to respond to the question about Kuhn and Sasse?
If you would like to. If you don't want to, you
Sasse is clearly libertarian. We agree on that. Kuhn, not. He does not say that there is no progress in science. There is no such thing as... In fact, he argued explicitly against relativism, in fact. He doesn't take a radical position like I do. So, yeah, I don't see a lot of this in the work itself.
Okay. My question to
Sorry,
you...
I will send quotations to anybody.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Please do.
My question to you, Thaddeus, is where I got perplexed. I mentioned to you before you, when you arrived that I was excited by the research you'd done into World War II and whether it was really a necessary war. And I listened to your interview, the first interview you did with Dave Smith. We were actually telling him, and I was struck by your words, I jotted them down, that the argument has to be airtight about World War II. You said airtight. And then, your words, I am now completely convinced, and this is a fairly new thing for me, and then you said again, completely convinced, emphasized, that Western intervention in World War II killed way, way, way more people than it saved. We're not going to debate that issue tonight. But my question to you is, if I hear a postmodernist say twice that he's got an airtight case and that he's completely convinced, then I wonder what the heck is the difference between me and that guy if he's completely convinced.
Right. So I am operating as a historian within a modernist frame. So that's where Stephen was actually somewhat right about me.
Oh, okay.
So to convince other historians and the general public, you have to operate within a particular sphere. So postmodernists don't say that there is no such thing as logic or logic is irrelevant. It is, of course, quite relevant in our world. It's relevant in the world I inhabit. I come from Columbia University. I'm trained by professional academics to work within that world. And this is what Foucault actually said himself. He says, I use reason against rationalism. I use the tools of power against power. I use their own logic to disrupt their own logic. That's what I'm doing in my work in history. I'm simply using their evidence, their logic, to call into question their basic claims.
That's what you meant when you say you were completely convinced. You meant to say...
I meant within the logic of history, yes.
Okay.
As it is written so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Did you want to comment on that, Stephen?
Yes. Thaddeus, with all respect, is wrestling with exactly the paradox that all skeptics, subjectivists, and relativists wrestle with. They do want to say, on the one hand, and Thaddeus mentions his social upbringing, I was conditioned to a large extent by my academic training to accept logic and evidence, right, and so forth. But then, of course, the hardcore postmodernists are simply going to come back and say, well, that's just one community. Right, and one set of standards, and why is the logic and evidence set of standards any better than any other set of standards? And there is no answer to that within postmodernism. It's just I'm making a subjective commitment to it. And that's exactly why two generations later we have a whole generation of university students, right? I think they still are a loud and noisy minority who are not at all interested in playing that language game, and that's what they've been taught. Language is just a game. And you manipulate logic, you manipulate evidence, you use any rhetorical trick in order to advance your group's value judgment. And they will then say, yeah, I will be willing to play that game with you in this particular context, but I'm not making any claims that it's correct or not. If we're interested in politics of individual liberty, we want to say, no, the evidence is on our side, the logic is on our side, and this holds for everybody, not just people who've chosen or been conditioned to believe a certain set of definitions.
I think Thaddeus wants to...
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that. So there is nothing in my book, in my work, anywhere that is true. I never speak the truth. I'm telling stories. I'm telling new stories or different stories or trying to anyway, new narratives, and you can like them or not. I don't think they're any more true than any other story about the Holocaust or about World War II. Now, I use evidence that other people use against them or against the game that they're playing, but I don't claim that this is an absolute universal truth that is going to apply for all time. That would be highly arrogant of me.
All right. You want to make a...
Yeah. Okay, yes. I would like to be very arrogant, right? Okay. I would like to say that slavery is a moral abomination. Okay. What do you think, Thaddeus?
So what exactly does that get you, right? So here's... No. So here's the answer. Okay, that was not what ended slavery. What ended slavery was the mobilization of hundreds of thousands of people to kill hundreds of thousands of other people, right? That's what ended slavery. The moral abomination part wasn't influencing the Union soldiers who went down south. Most of them were racist as anybody, right? And actually, many of them supported slavery. They did it either because they were conscripted or because they thought it was the only decent job in town. Or they simply supported this idea of the nation state. We don't know. But most importantly, and actually they were more concerned about the slave power, the power of the slave masters, than the slaves themselves.
The intellectual movement in Britain, Thaddeus, against slavery.
Yes.
Did that help end slavery in the British?
Yes.
It did.
To some extent, not much, though. The abolitionist movement was a minor player.
Well, I'm talking about the British movement in England that ended slavery in South America.
It was part of it, but...
Okay, it was part of it. Okay. But
here's an important point, though. No. So not in this country at all, though.
No.
And that's a consensus among historians.
This country is not the only history.
No, I know, but so here's the interesting thing about the abolitionist movement. Yeah. Stephen calls that a triumph of enlightenment, individualistic thinking. Does anyone know about who the abolitionists in this country and in England were and what was influencing them and what was really driving them? What made them anti-slavery? Was a deep, deep belief in Christianity, in particular in this country, Calvinism. The oldest, most rigid, most superstitious, you could say, forms of Christianity. It was not an enlightenment movement at all. If you know anything about the history of abolitionism, it was as Christian as the day is long, had nothing to do with science or reason or rationality. In fact, it was a very pre-modern movement.
Just another question for Thaddeus. Part of Thaddeus's first round of argumentation was to point out the terrible state abuses of power in psychiatry with respect to gays, Jews, women, and so forth. So my question would be, do you think that those were morally wrong abuses of state power, or do you think that it's a narrative interpretation that you believe that those things are wrong, but there are other alternative narrations that could justify the state use of power mm-hmm. against blacks, Jews, women, and so forth.
Right. So morality to me is a form of superstition. So it is the idea that something applies, again, to all people at all times and all places forever. Right. That is a religious idea. I hope that's clear. I hope it's clear. You can't prove that. You can't disprove it either. But that is a hell of an arrogant claim that is very similar to what you find in the Bible, isn't it? Right? That something is going to apply eternally to all people in all places. I find that incredibly arrogant. Now, does this mean that I am not opposed to slavery? No. I don't want to live in a society that has slavery in it because of my values. That's a different thing than morality. So what I tell people, and I've told my students this for decades, don't worry about what is morally good or morally wrong. Figure out what you want, what you value. And as a Randian objectivist, you should appreciate this. It's the politics of self-interest that I'm preaching here. If you want to live in a society that includes slavery, I'm going to fight you if you're going to try to impose that on me. Right? If you want to not live in a society with slavery, that's all you need. You don't need to make moral claims, do you? If you don't want to live in a society like that includes slavery, you would have picked up a gun in 1861 and gone down south, maybe. Or you would simply have refused, by force of arms, the entrance of slave states into the North. So just figure out what you want and move from there politically. It's just a question of strategy once you know what your value is. Instead of, we get stuck in this idea about what other people should want, how other people should live. Which I find to be, not find to be, but I would submit, is the root, the origin of imperialism. Not just cultural, but political and military as well. You will find in the case of every imperialist movement, every imperialist general, every imperialist great conqueror, they begin with a claim that those people over there should live according to the way that I think because it is morally right. This goes all the way back to the Crusades, right? Think about the Crusades. A whole bunch of people thought that people in the Middle East were living in a bad way, in an immoral way, and what happened next? And that goes all the way up to the present time. Every imperialist campaign from every country in the history of the world began with universal truth claims, universal moralistic truth claims. I say let's get out of the business of that and let's move toward individualistic value claims and operating our politics from that.
All right, thanks. And first question, please phrase it as a question. Go ahead. Please, go ahead.
This is for both or either. Does postmodernism teach that there are no absolutes? So mathematical, let's say Pythagoras' theorem, ethical, rape is wrong. Let's say economic, the law of supply and demand. No truths whatsoever?
I guess that's mainly, go ahead, Stephen.
Yes.
No.
Okay.
Explanation.
Okay,
The postmodern theory of language is that language is a social construct. How terms are defined is arbitrarily as a result of tradition. That applies universally, and that is a universalistic claim. But then that just means that, and all of the analytic and skeptical continental thinkers that the postmoderns are drawing on when they are getting their first-rate PhD education say explicitly, logical truths are true only because we have decided to make them true. It's a subjective projection. The truths of mathematics and how we have defined the axioms are true only because we have stipulated them to be so. They don't say anything about the way things are out in the world.
I would challenge Stephen or anyone else to find any of these postmodernist thinkers that we've discussed saying anything like that.
I will send the quotations.
Okay. So They simply do not. They simply write the history of these claims. Like with Kuhn, in Kuhn's case, he would have written the history of the Pythagoras theorem and shown that it was invented by a particular man at a particular time and particular place. Right now, is it true universally? Well, all we know is, as Kuhn said, that these truth claims within science get overturned pretty much every single day. Even just recently, last couple of years, they found something moving in outer space that didn't comport with the theory of gravity. Okay, again, the idea of, you know, of atoms and spaces between them, that's a relatively new idea, which was craziness before we discovered that, or we think we discovered that. No, it is simply, this has not ever been a claim by postmodernists. They simply want to be skeptical, not atheistic, agnostic about all these questions. Agnostic and skeptical.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Patrick Doward, and I guess my question is more for Dr. Russell. How do you...
Don't call me doctor.
All right. Sorry. For Thaddeus. How do you reconcile bad science with not throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
Can you unpack that just a bit? I'm not exactly sure what you're
asking. As far as like some of the examples you gave us, like eugenics or scientific racism,
right,
being the bathwater.
Okay, so what do you want? Do you want eugenics? Do you want people to be divided by their gene pools and then the people with inferior gene pools to be weeded out from the population? No. Do you want a cure for cancer? Then you might want to support that, right? You might want to support that part of science. I do. I love medical advances. I love much of medical science because it makes me healthier, makes me happier, makes me... Right. Now, again, is that going to be... Let's think about, he brought up nutrition and diet, right? Will those methods, those techniques in medical science always be right, the best things to do? So now we all believe, what, that carbs are terrible for you, right, and fat is good for you. Well, remember about 15 years ago when it was just the other way around? And wait till the next diet fad. And that's just in nutrition. So scientists, ask a scientist. They're revising truth all the time. All the time. That's what you do as a scientist. You don't get up in the morning and say, you know what? We're done with gravity. We've discovered, we know the truth. We know the truth and we're done. Stop studying it. No, scientists study gravity every single day, all over the world, don't they? They study all of the questions that many people think are settled. There are no settled questions. This is the problem with modernist thinking, right? They believe that you can get to it. You can get to an end point and find the truth. It's anti-intellectual. If we close a question, that means there is no studying left to do. That means there's no science left to do. It's also anti-science. Scientists should be, and they themselves will tell you this, relentlessly skeptical, relentlessly questioning, and relentlessly revising. That's what good scientists have always done. Don't ask me, ask them.
Comment from you, Steve?
Go ahead. Sorry, I was going to let the applause go. Sorry. Thaddeus is...
Hey, call me Thad, really. Thad. It's fine.
Okay, got it.
We've known each other a long time.
Professor Russell, yeah.
Okay. Is presenting to us a false alternative, right? On the one hand, we're supposed to say science means that everything is fixed, final, complete, that somehow scientists have acquired this omniscient understanding, and then and only then can we use the words truth, knowledge, and certainty. But since we don't have that, we should, and this is your bathwater issue, throw out the concepts of truth, throw out the knowledge, the claims, throw out the claim that we can ever be certain. And that's a false alternative. Right? And I don't want to say it's somewhere in the middle, but proper science is a low-grade skepticism, does have a place in science. We should, every generation, every individual, think for ourselves about all of the claims. But the truth is, some people do know more than others. Some people have a better understanding of the evidence than other people do. Some people have spent more time and have done more logic. And we do know some things, right, in science. We know that the sun generates heat, right? For example. We know that gravity is actually a real force in the world. Now, when you start with the basic things, those things don't get changed. When we get to very complicated theories, of course, then we need to be more hypothetical, more speculative, more probabilistic in our thinkings. But don't think it's an all or nothing. There is no truth, or we have absolute infinite truth right now. We're working the territory.
Next question.
Hi, Ted Farris. I just wanted to see if Thaddeus and Stephen could comment on whether this gets at the distinction between your views, which is that absolutes exist and absolutes don't exist. So there is an epistemic split between subject and object in the universe. People perceive things subjectively. There is no objective observer. God was invented to be the objective observer. But because there is no objective observer, there are no absolutes. There can be no absolute truth. And when you talk about morality, it's just silly because morality developed as a way for people to cooperate in groups and to have rules of behavior. So if you're a moral realist, it's really just silly because morality differs in every different culture and group.
All right. Comment? You want to comment first, Stephen? Yeah. Go on, Stephen.
Yeah, so I'll just take up the issue of morality and objectivity. So let's take the phenomenon of traffic and the rules that we have evolved with respect to traffic and what's the status of those rules. Now, we could say at one level, driving on the left side of the road or driving on the right side of the road, there's no God that specifies, right? And there's no, you know, when we started driving, flags that sprang out of the ground and said, thou shalt drive on the right side of the road. Okay. So we decided those things. And so there is, with respect to many moral principles and moral rules, wiggle room and decisions that are largely operative. But the fact is that human beings are real. The fact is that cars are real. The fact is, objectively so, that people want to get various places. The facts are that if people collide with each other in multi-ton vehicles, they will be damaged. So there are objective facts and objective values that we are trying to resolve in a social context. And we make rules to say there has to be one side or the other. That's an objective fact if we're actually going to get to our places safely. So it's a combination of objective facts, objective needs that we have identified properly that leads us to make certain decisions, but often there is wiggle room in those particular decisions, and that's where the so-called subjective element comes in.
A comment, Thaddeus?
I second what you said. I don't know if anything to add to that.
Okay. Next question.
My question's for Dr. Hicks. I'm going to frame it in terms of an intuition pump so we don't have to argue about the parameters. So imagine a world where there are advances in neuroscience and psychology that we can say by age 10 that this individual will be a sexual sadist or a psychopathic killer. To put it differently, we can say with scientific certainty that these individuals will impinge on the freedom of others if they are left to be free. So my question is, what happens to your epistemological claim that all humans have a birthright, or I forget how you said it, but essentially a right to freedom?
Well, the right to freedom is not infringed. Everybody still has the right to freedom, but your right to freedom ends where other people's freedoms are being infringed upon. So your sadomasochistic killer...
No, they're not. They're 10 years old.
That's right.
For predicting this.
So once they don't have a right, an absolute right, to engage in those kinds of actions. So what I would then say is, it would be a normal police thing. If you have good knowledge that someone is likely to commit a crime, then you engage in surveillance. But you engage in surveillance to the extent that you have good evidence. You get search warrants and so forth. So I would then say, yeah, in this science fiction scenario, the police should start following that guy around very closely. Now, there's not going to be any prior restraint, but yes, you put a security cordon around that guy to prevent him from engaging in the actions.
Any comment?
Not very libertarian of you, I must say. It sounds like Minority Report to me, except worse. With eugenics added to it.
Next question.
Yeah. Hi, my question is for Thaddeus. I wanted to follow up on a question that came up earlier about whether science has made any definitive claims yet or whether it's always evolving. And Stephen brought up a few examples. My favorite is the Earth is round. So I would like Thaddeus for you to explain to me how to wrap my mind around this in a postmodern way. So let me be very specific. How would you, or how could I, think of the world is round as not true in a universal way? Right? I mean, that seems to me a scientific claim. It was achieved through scientific methods. But how could it be? You seem to be saying that it's true maybe within a context, but not outside that context, or within the context of certain claims, but not universally true. So how do you wrap your mind around this idea that the Earth is round, this claim, the Earth is round, is not universally true?
Well, I would just say... It doesn't matter.
Please, no heckling from the audience. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Was that a flat earther out there? Get them out of here. That's just not true. It's just not scientifically true. We know this.
Okay. Please.
She's actually right. So first of all...
We have to maintain it.
So first it was flat, and everybody was completely sure it was flat. Everybody, right? And you were burned at the stake if you disbelieved that. And then everybody believed it was a perfect sphere. And this is kind of getting where you're at, right? Where you're coming from, right? And now it's sort of oblong and bumpy and not exactly round, right? Well, here's the question then. Should we then stop studying the question of whether the Earth is round? No. If you're a scientist, you study everything. You keep researching. And maybe this is not answering your question, but...
I wasn't claiming that... my question had nothing to do with how the exact degree to which it's round. It's just that it's not flat.
All right,
we know it's round. It meets on the other end.
But do you see how...
That's all that my question needs.
But no. But do you see how the shape of the Earth keeps changing according to science? So it was flat, and then it was a perfect sphere, and now it's a bumpy, oblong thing. Do we stop studying it? I say no if you're an actual scientist.
Okay, yeah, we're running low on time.
So in response to this question, I would be willing to say the shape of the Earth is an objective fact, right? But it's not a universal truth. And the reasons for that are individualistic, that knowledge resides in individual minds, and what you know depends on what you as an individual have studied and learned. Now, it is an objective fact that the Earth is spherical for those who have looked at the evidence and so forth. But there are lots of people who have not looked at the evidence, so it's not a truth for them. If you ask them, is the Earth spherical or not, and they're 4 years old, I don't know, I never thought about it, the right answer for that person would be to say, I don't know, to be agnostic on it. So it's not yet a truth for that person because they've not processed, even though for those who have studied it, it's objectively true that the Earth is spherical.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last... we've got one more minute. Okay, one final question. Please, go ahead. Okay.
Yeah. Hi, this is directed to Mr. Russell.
Don't call me Mr.
Okay.
Professor Russell.
Okay.
Do you believe anything actually exists? Or actually, no. Do you know anything actually exists?
I'm not sure I exist anymore. I don't. Can you... a little bit more of that. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me. What do you mean actually? Actually exists?
Do you believe anything is real?
Okay. So I don't know is my answer. I am an agnostic on this question. It is a possibility that... you're not there, and I'm not here. I don't operate in the world like that. I don't walk down the street thinking, oh, my God, I might disappear. I might not be real. Right? I'm operating in the world that my head is in. Okay? I just know that there have been so many fundamental beliefs like that that were believed across societies that have not just been revised but radically overthrown that I remain skeptical about everything. Like, again, the sun revolving around the Earth. Everyone believed that. Everyone believed that. This floor was completely solid and had no spaces in it, right? So even on that, yes, I just say, let's be skeptical. Let's be actual scientists. That's what postmodernism is.
Stephen, maybe you want to address that in your final summation. That'd be good. So you have 5 minutes to summarize.
Oh, okay. So here's an essentialist claim that's often made every year by this thing called the IRS. They say to you, well, you're an American. You were born on this piece of land. And that means you must, because you are an American, essentially, fundamentally, you must give us your money. That's an essentialist claim. The nation state, that's born of essentialism too. If you're born on a piece of land at a particular time, you are a German or you're an American or you're a Canadian or whatever it is, and that means X, Y, and Z about you. It also means that you have to serve your country every once in a while, go to war and fight and die. Now, postmodernists would say, excuse me very much. What? Why on earth? Just by dumb luck, I was born here. I had no choice in this, right? But that means that I'm an American and that I have all these obligations and duties to this place I didn't even choose to live in, right? Postmodernists would say, let's ask some questions about that. Let's write the history of it. Let's study the history of it. That's what Foucault would say. And he would find out that, oh, no, actually, you know, this was a land that was conquered by one people over another people, and they imposed this nation state on it. And by the way, that happened about 5 minutes ago in world history, if you look at it, right? The nation state is a very, very new phenomenon. It's only about a couple hundred years old. But we all walk around thinking like, oh my God, I am American in my soul, don't we? Don't we? Germans thought, I am German in my soul. And that means all these things about me. What a fiction that is, quite obviously. And I would say a pretty destructive fiction too. So if you look at all the casualties of the last 200 years in the world, including just all the killings, all the murders in the world, I'm going to say that the nation state and people acting on behalf of the nation state have killed more human beings in the last 200 years than all the other actors combined. There's no doubt about that, especially in the 20th century, the culmination, the pinnacle of modernism and scientism and a belief in reason and rationality. The 20th century was nothing but killing fields. The greatest murders of human beings on a mass scale ever. World War I, World War II, the anti-colonial revolts, Vietnam, goes on and on and on. All, again, conducted by engineers with state power, acting very rationally, studying things, looking at maps. You know who ran the Vietnam War, right? Guys from Harvard. All the best and the brightest, didn't they? It was their idea, the Vietnam War. Oh, and they're also the ones who invented napalm. And they're also the ones who built the airplanes that dropped the bombs. All in the name of science and reason and rationality, and improving these people, lifting them up from their savage, pre-civilized existence into the modern world. That's what was said, has always been said, about imperialism. That's what it is. It's good for them. We're raising them up into the modern world. We're going to give them the advances of science. We're going to do that by killing half of them first. And then we're going to put them in our schools, which are also run by scientists and engineers and rational, reasonable people. So, again, I really like some things that science and reason and rationality. By the way, I love Reason Magazine so much, except for the name of the damn thing. Let's work on that. So, yeah, reason, rationality, science have given me medicine that I use, that I really enjoy. I love flying in airplanes. It's great to just get in this thing and I end up in another city the next in a few hours. Fantastic. But as I said before, those airplanes are and have been used for other purposes, pretty nasty purposes, and will be in the future most likely. The atom bomb. We love that thing, don't we? Who was that invented by? Scientists. So let's at least be skeptical whenever it is claimed that scientists are right and science is true. Let's be skeptical of this thing that I think, who invented the term scientism? Oh, it was this guy named F.A. Hayek, a great libertarian. Scientism, he said, is the belief in science as a religion. The belief that scientists have access to truth that the rest of us don't, that science arrives at universal, eternal truth, that is scientism. The idea that even gravity, the theory of gravity, will never change, will never be revised, has already been proven false. Every major scientific claim has been revised or overthrown. And again, that's what scientists do, if you're really a scientist or really a postmodernist. But most importantly, postmodernism and a belief in personal liberty, I think, should be twinned, should be paired, and could create a brand new movement and maybe a new iteration of libertarianism that might actually make me, for the first time in my life, identify as a libertarian. So we'll see. Thank you for listening, and I hope you Hope you vote for the proposition.
I'd like to second Thad's remarks about the horrors of 20th century political history. And certainly there have been abuses up and down every continent and so forth. The problem is not science. The problem is collectivism. You look at the death tolls, the Nazis, the fascists, the communists in China, the communists in the Soviet Union. All of them were, as young people, committed to a strongly collectivist, anti-individualistic, anti-liberal methodology. As a secondary overlay, way they would use pragmatically when they thought it helpful, various scientific theories. They would draw upon science in order to serve their collectivistic ends. So the issue here is not science in places where individuality is respected. It's science being abused by collectivists. Now, the connection then to postmoderns is that the postmoderns are in their understanding of human nature and their understanding of human cognition. Actually, they don't believe in human cognition, and their understanding of human, whatever it is that we do with our minds, and our understanding of human values are deeply and thoroughly collectivistic. If we want the fruits of science, we do, as this one gentleman says, that we need to sort the good from the bad. The only way we're going to sort the good from the bad is by ongoing commitment to doing the experimenting, doing the logic, doing the reason, but we have to respect the individuals all the way through. Science combined with individualism has brought the modern world, and I'm sure we have all seen the charts. You go the timeline of human history, when humans were tribal and pre-scientific and mystical religious and so forth, flatline and all of the indicators of human well-being. And it's not until we get to the early modern world where individualism starts to be taken seriously, the belief in capacity for all individuals to think for themselves, to make their own judgments, that individual pursuit of happiness is a universal birthright, and we then seriously start to try to extend it not only to the white males who first came up with the idea, but to non-white males, to women, to people of different religions. That is when we started to make progress, and the progress has been astonishing. So there are facts in the world. With hard work and rational commitment, we can come to know them. At the same time, we do need to be aware of our limits, right, and not be hubristic in overstating what we do and what we do not know. But what we do know is that there is one philosophy in the entire history of human beings that has enabled us to enjoy the prosperity and the tolerance and the extended lifestyles and all of the gadgets that make us happy to be living in the 21st century. And we have learned also the negative lessons, and I think Thad has half learned some of those negative lessons, right? Yes, the abuses of state power are wrong, but notice that he is agreeing that abuses of state power are wrong. That is a universalist claim. That's an objectivist claim he is making about abuses of state power. And I don't think he's going to want to say, or maybe he would want to say, it's only my personal preference that abuses of state power are a wrong thing. Right? We want something more than that, and we can do it, right? But it takes a certain philosophy. Now, the postmoderns don't believe, as we've heard tonight, right, that we can say that there's a difference between reality and unreality. Right? If you think that everything is a subjective reality, then any sort of politics of individual liberty is not going to matter to you. If you don't think that reason is competent, then you're not going to try very hard to be rational. And if we're not going to try very hard to be rational, we're not going to get science, we're not going to get democracy, we're not going to get a free market. All of those depend on people being rational and so forth. If we don't believe that individuals are the units of value, that each person has their own inherent dignity, the right to the pursuit of happiness, then we're not going to tolerate people who are different from us. So tolerance is a deep universal respect for other people's individuality, and that has to be held as an objective universal principle. The only places and the only times in history where we have made progress, and the progress has been real, the status of women, the status of gays, the status of blacks, and all of the other races. The fact that we can be in a city like New York and just look at all that has been achieved, right? Postmodernism is never going to build a skyscraper. Right? Instead, what it's going to do is argue that the skyscraper is a phallic symbol and a tool of, yes, white male imperialism, and we know the rest of the story. So please vote no.
Well, please register your final vote on your smartphone. Postmodernism is necessary for a politics of individual liberty. Please vote. Meanwhile, I do want to announce that Thaddeus will be hosting Thaddeus Russell's unregistered live event. If you put that into a search engine, I guess you'll find it. That will feature Dave Smith, whom you heard tonight, as well as Nick Gillespie, who you also saw tonight. You want those three guys back? Then you can see it tomorrow night in Brooklyn, Thaddeus Russell's unregistered live event. Tickets are still available with Dave Smith and Nick Gillespie. Next month, Monday, August 12th, we'll have another debate on Bitcoin. I do urge you to buy your tickets now. That Bitcoin event is selling out fast. The resolution will be Bitcoin is poorly suited to the purpose of becoming any nation's main medium of exchange. Defending that resolution will be George Selgin against Safedean Amous. That's August 12th, our debate on Bitcoin, Monday, August 12th. On Tuesday, September 10th, Dave Smith will be back again, not only giving us a warm-up act, but also debating, in this case, debating Nicholas Sarwark on the future of the Libertarian Party. Dave will be doing double-dipping that evening. That's August, September 10th. And then afterwards, at our home, two blocks away, the loft apartment that I share with the Sacco, we're going to host a fundraising event for the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party. Michael Heiss will be there. I will be there. Dave Smith and a couple of other people. That will be hosted at our home, just two blocks away. We'll give you the address then if you show or you want to go. We will be posting that event on our website very soon for you to come to that charitable event on behalf of the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party. On Monday, October 7th, we're going to have a debate on drug use. Jacob Sullen of Reason Magazine. What's a better name for the magazine? Unreason? What do you think?
Postmodernism.
Postmodern Magazine, no, Reason Magazine, Jacob Sullum, will be defending the resolution. A little bit of a mouthful, but he wanted to be careful. Except for laws prohibiting the sale of drugs to minors and driving while impaired, all laws that penalize drug production, distribution, possession, and use should be abolished, along with special sin taxes on drugs. Covers the map pretty well there, and Thaddeus is going to vote yes on the resolution, I can see. And he will be debating former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson, author of Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. No? We have the results, of the vote, So the yes vote on the resolution began at, and we take it to the second decimal place because my man Yuri, who developed the program, was careful, 7.07% voted yes initially. That rose to 18.18%. So that means that the yes vote gained 11.11%. That's the number to beat, 11.11%. The initial no started at 33.33% and rose to 67.68% to a 34%. But again, both of you gained votes. Congratulations. However, the Tootsie Roll goes to Stephen.